PD Pods present the Corona Cast. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a new week and a new episode of the Corona Cast presented by PD Pods and myself, Pranay Budev. There has been a lot of talk about why certain patients are more severely affected by COVID-19, especially those who have no underlying medical conditions and sometimes even children. There has been talk about there being genetic susceptibility to this, and therefore I'm very grateful to invite back one of our previous guests from the PD Pods cast, Dr. Melita Irving, who is a consultant geneticist at Guy St. Thomas' Hospital with a special interest in rare diseases and skeletal dysplasias. She is an active researcher and was the Royal Society of Medicine genetic section president a few years ago, and has also recently authored a book called The Human DNA Manual. Melita, thank you for joining me and opening up Pandora's box on the genetic questions underlying COVID.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
So tell me, what are your thoughts and when was it first really brought up that people may be more genetically susceptible to having more severe symptoms?
Well, as you know, the whole situation with COVID-19 is a very fast-moving one, and we're learning more and more all the time in a very short space of time. As the epidemics, which then became a pandemic, unraveled, it started to become more apparent that there were certain people in the population that were more prone to, in particular, the severe complications of COVID-19. And that appeared to be older people and people with more than one comorbidity. So, for example, high blood pressure and diabetes and obesity. And then it became apparent that it was even more likely that it would be men that are more susceptible to the complications. And that was originally seen in Wuhan in China, but then it was replayed in other countries like Italy and Spain. And so that the premise there was that perhaps men are more risky with their behavior. They're more likely to smoke and not look after themselves. I've even read things that suggest that men are even less likely to wash their hands than women. And maybe that was the underlying reason for the fact that men were more likely to get the severe complications of COVID-19. But then when we started to see atypical presentations of severe infection, in other words, much younger people being affected, then it started to become apparent that maybe there was some underlying genetic predisposition to that, especially when we considered that these more severe presentations were happening to people who were thought previously to be fit and well. And then I was also aware of some familial clusters as well. And whilst the first thought around that might be, well, that could be explained by shared environment, perhaps people who live together and are related are more likely to be faced with a much higher viral load, and that could be the explanation. Well, to me, I thought maybe these people also share genetic variations, and maybe there's something about our genetic code that could explain the behavior of COVID-19. There are many, many different reasons why genetics is important in considering why and how and in what way COVID-19 affects people and based on their genetic code.
And obviously there was recently announcement from the government that they're going to be setting up a task force to see why this has affected people of a BAME background. What are your thoughts on this? And do you think, again, is there a genetic susceptibility in that population group? Or could it be obviously a mixture between genetics and the environment, which is what we sort of talked about on our first podcast?
Yeah, so we talked about the fact that studying rare diseases can give us fantastic insights into common complex disorders. And we know that with common complex disorders, there are contributions from environment and also from genetic background. And studying rare diseases can help us really focus in on the genetic elements of more complex disorders, but that's notwithstanding the fact that environmental factors are really important as well. So I think the same situation is going to play out with COVID-19 infection, in that there will clearly be environmental factors that come into play, but I'm convinced that there will also be a number of genetic factors that are also influencing COVID-19 infection. So who gets it, And how severely they get it, and indeed in what form they get it, because we know that COVID-19 is not just one disease, it takes on many different phases, and one person can be relatively minorly affected by it, but others can be much more severely affected by it and in different ways. So there are different phases that are becoming apparent in COVID-19, which again may have a genetic element to it. And also, I think we did talk about this in our previous podcast about epigenetic factors, and environmental exposures can also influence the way your genetic code works and what proteins are expressed, because environmental factors such as smoking can alter the genetic code, not the code itself, but the way it's expressed, because additional chemical compounds can be applied to the genetic code, meaning that certain genes are less likely to be expressed, and other proteins are more likely to be expressed, depending on the differences in that additional genetic marker. So I think there are going to be lots of different things that come out as an explanation for our observations of the demographics behind severe COVID-19 infection, but certainly genetics could well be a major factor, including in the BAME group.
Now, obviously, there is the UK Biobank that has, you know, over 500,000 volunteers, blood, urine, saliva samples. And I believe they've enrolled in this sort of grassroots consortium that's been set up almost as a worldwide collaborative to sort of justify and see what could be underlying it. Tell me a bit about that worldwide effort that's going on.
So I think we have seen in other genetic studies that there is huge power in collaboration and in pooling data and pooling experience and pooling approaches and expertise into how the data is analyzed. So I think I also said to you before that it's junk in and junk out with genetic analyses. You have to really have really good data and analyze it in a very specific way to get the answers that you're looking for. And so international collaborations in looking into the genetics behind COVID-19 infection is going to be crucial at this stage. And we're also seeing that that the disease can play out differently in different countries. And so to bring together an international collaboration will be really important. And the fact that the UK can contribute to that international effort is something to be proud of. And we already have a great track record of genetic testing and for genome-wide association studies and helping to pinpoint genetic factors behind these common complex disorders. So what the UK Biobank is doing and what the NIHR, the National Institute for Health Research, is also contributing, and other pockets of research around the UK is really important to that international effort. And it's only really possible because a lot of research in the UK has been put on hold. So most of my clinical trials that we've talked about before have been put on hold, really to focus our efforts on treating COVID-19 in the NHS and to redeploy staff who might otherwise be working on research studies to use their skills in other settings to help with increasing capacity in the NHS. This is a really important phase of research which has been given priority to allow these studies to be put through much more quickly, because there's an urgency here to get as much information and to put things through as quickly as possible to get approvals and to generate data to help in real time as quickly as possible around this.
Yeah, the one thing we're finding is that, you know, the red tape has almost been removed, which is really nice, because we're actually seeing tremendous advances in innovation in both clinical and research practice. Tell me, what are you currently doing? Because you mentioned to me before we started recording this about a couple of projects you're working on with regards to coronavirus.
Yeah, so we were having a little catch up, weren't we, about what's happening in my work life at Guy's and St. Thomas's. And just like every other trust, we have been asked to detail our skill set so that we can identify people that could be redeployed to areas where there might be a higher sickness rate to fill in some gaps, all with a view to keeping things going as much as possible and to increased capacity in the NHS to meet this head on. So I thought, well, what are my skill sets? What can I contribute to this effort? And of course, I work in rare diseases. I not only look after patients with rare diseases because they need looking after, but I apply principles around rare diseases to other situations in which there may be genetic susceptibility. So in particular, common complex disorders. And a great example of that was a study we did in osteoporosis that affects children. And we learned a lot from that we could then apply to much more common forms of osteoporosis that affect people later on in life. So it occurred to me that perhaps using a rare disease approach to COVID-19 might then allow us to tease out some of those genetic elements. And so I'm running a study with Lucy Raymond and with Patrick Chinnery at Cambridge University, focusing on people with severe COVID infection who are under the age of 40, because that's what we deem to be an atypical group in the same way that we identified children with rare diseases as being atypical. And we are performing whole genome sequencing in those individuals and both their parents. So that's a trio whole genome sequence. And we have demonstrated that that's a really useful strategy in detecting rare disease variants that might give us an idea of whether there is an underlying genetic disorder, perhaps of the immune system, perhaps a neuromuscular disorder that could predispose to severe infection, or whether there might be something about that child or that young person's immune system, which means that they're more likely to develop the severe complications of COVID-19. And comparing an affected person with their parents allows us really very quickly to drill down from some of the less important variants in the genetic code that are innocent, or SNPs, as we've talked about before, to the much more important, potentially disease-causing changes in the genetic code that could predispose to this infection.
So do you think there's something underlying, like an inborn error of immunity? Is that something that can that makes people more susceptible to this?
Well, I don't know what it's going to turn out to be, but we know that there are several different stages in which viral infection is important. So, for example, the way the virus interacts with the host in the first place. So there's been a lot of attention on the ACE2 gene and protein, because ACE2, the angiotensin converting enzyme type 2, is known to be the receptor for the virus. So the virus hooks onto the receptor, the ACE2 receptor, and then injects its viral contents into the host cell, and then gets the cell to make the new viral packages for it, and then it's released into the host, and that's when it starts to cause problems. And those problems themselves are with the immune system, so there might be a hyperinflammatory response in some people, the so-called cytokine storm, and for some people, there might be severe pneumonia or pneumonitis. So people are reacting in different ways. And so genetics could come into play at all of those different stages, right from the viral host interaction to how the cell makes the new viruses, to how the body responds to that viral infection, to some much more severe manifestations of the disease that not everybody gets. So why is there differences in the way the body responds? Well, maybe that's genetic.
And it's, you know, it's amazing to see how important genetics is in actually not only investigating this virus's effects on specific people, but actually probably identifying the origin of the virus, what the virus itself consists of, and how it can potentially help us tackle it with vaccines in the future. So let's sort of tackle that from the beginning. I know there must be places that are trying to find out where this originated from. Did it come from bats in a wet market? What work has been done in sort of identifying the origins of coronavirus?
So two main things are really going on in that respect, in terms of the genetics of coronavirus, of this particular strain of coronavirus. So firstly, there's an international effort to sequence the genome of this particular strain of coronavirus to map the mutations that are occurring, because viruses are renowned for being highly mutable and very quickly, and that's because there is so much nucleic acid and in this case RNA replication that that mistakes or changes in the genome do occur rapidly. So efforts to sequence the genome of the virus are international based, because then we can start to track is the virus in Italy taking on a different form to the one in London compared to the original one in Wuhan compared to a virus in Brazil. So there are international efforts to really track that the mutations that are occurring within the virus. And then just as an aside, tracking the virus in that way, and rather than working forwards to see how it's mutating, but working backwards to check out its origins, also allows us to have some idea about where it's come from, and also to dispel some of the conspiracy theories which suggested it was created in a lab in China. Instead, science is showing that it's had evolved from a virus that was already present in bats and probably went into humans via another animal, and that's been suggested as the pangolin.
And how about, obviously you mentioned about getting the sort of genetic blueprint of the virus there, and you know, understanding that it's mutating, and typically, you know, viruses mutate, which is why we have the seasonal flu. Is this going to help us develop a management for this, in the sense that we're all waiting for the day that a vaccine comes out that is safe? Is genetics going to play a role in helping us develop a vaccine?
Yes, so I'm no virologist and I'm no vaccine developer, but I think genetics has to play a role in moving us forward. We know that developing vaccines is a hugely complex undertaking for so many different reasons, not least because you might create a vaccine for a virus that then can evade that vaccine because it's mutated. So understanding how the genome is changing in the virus might then allow us to identify areas of that genome which seem to be much more stable, perhaps. Then we can target those areas or the proteins that are translated from that part of the viral genome to focus our vaccine development upon. But this is not a straightforward process at all, and that's why it takes a long time to develop a vaccine to develop something in the laboratory before it's even gone through safety testing.
And how do you feel genetics as a specialty is going to change or indeed benefit from this sort of COVID pandemic? I mean, we're all finding that we're innovating quite quickly and changing the way we do things. Do you think removing some of this red tape and bureaucracy and doing studies, do you think there's going to be a benefit to the way genetics is practiced in the future?
Yeah, I think increasingly it will become more appreciated that genetics plays a role in our everyday lives, not in every single aspect of it. I think, you know, one of the outcomes of all the genetic studies around this disease might be to allow us to develop some risk stratification. So even if we don't come up with a vaccine immediately, maybe we can come up with some markers or some clues from the genetic code which suggest that one person might be more likely to experience severe complications of COVID-19, whereas somebody else might be much less susceptible to them. And in that respect, we can either prioritize those people who are more susceptible based on their DNA to vaccination programs, or we can keep them isolated or keep them off the front line in the case of healthcare workers of BAME, for example. Just understanding how genetics can play a role in everyday life is going to be much more apparent, I think, and will influence personalized medicine in a way that we had only dreamed about before, but perhaps will become much more part of everyday medicine.
And you know, I want, you know, we're quite lucky in the sense we're not on the COVID wards managing patients. We're sort of doing different things within our area of expertise and our skill set. What do you think genetic testing in healthcare workers would be beneficial at this point? I mean, it's obviously very difficult to even get a normal test right now, but do you think for future planning, you know, people should be screened instead of just being shielded as they have been at the moment?
Well, I think just taking things forward to a natural conclusion, we might be able to develop genetic tests in the future. If we identify particular susceptibility markers, then we could potentially use genetic testing to protect some people from being exposed, whether that's on the front line as healthcare workers or out in the community. So I do see a role for genetics in informing our decisions and our exposures in the future. But of course, that's going to take a huge amount of development within the field of genetic technology, and also a debate within society. How much do we use our genetics, our genetic code to influence who we are? People always talk about the slippery slope using DNA to create some kind of hierarchical society, and we need to be careful of that. That's not what we're trying to achieve, but I think our DNA holds so many clues to so many things that we would be silly not to harness it, but within with realistic expectations.
And that takes me nicely onto your book, because we spoke very briefly about it, but it's called The Human DNA Manual. And actually at this time, it's probably even more interesting because, you know, genetics has played such an important part in, as we've talked about, you know, identifying the origins of the virus to finding out which patients are more susceptible to it and potentially helping develop a vaccine. Tell us a bit about the book.
So the book is about DNA and all things genetic. It's called The Human DNA Manual, Understanding Your Genetic Code. And it's for people who don't have any previous background in understanding DNA, not people with PhDs or degrees in genetics. It's for people who are interested in genetics and DNA, but have always shied away from it because they thought it sounded complicated. So it's a book that's easy to understand for people who are interested but don't have any prior knowledge of DNA. And it talks about very fundamental things like what is DNA, and particularly relevant for now, what's the difference between DNA and RNA, because it's RNA that's in the coronavirus. And it talks about how DNA plays a role in our everyday lives and what it's taught us about the past. So there's sections about ancient DNA and tracking our ancestors back to Neanderthal times, how DNA is important in our health today, what the future uses of DNA might be. So there are lots of fun facts and practical things to do as well, because it's a Haynes manual, and some of the PD podcast listeners might remember Haynes manuals from perhaps back in the day when they or their parents used to fix their cars in the garage. And Haynes manuals now have lots of different subject matters. So there are lots of practical elements too. So you can extract DNA from strawberries in your own kitchen if you want to.
That's fantastic. And we'll put a link to the book in the show notes of this, because again, with everyone being on lockdown at home, it's probably a very interesting time to learn a bit about genetics. Melita, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today and explaining it so succinctly. Anything else you'd like to tell us about before we wrap up?
No, I don't think so. I just want to emphasise the importance of DNA and everything that we do. And it's a really fascinating area with COVID-19. And so for me, combining two fascinating areas can only lead to really important information. So yeah, watch this space.
Fantastic. Good. Well, thank you everyone for listening to this episode of the CoronaCast. I hope you're all keeping safe and well, and you and your loved ones. And again, stay tuned to hear more about the developments of the COVID-19 pandemic. Please share this with friends, family, and colleagues who you think may be interested. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram at PDPods, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.